Welcome, travellers, to the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast. Slide yourself into a disassociative fugue, and let's begin.
Welcome, traveller.
Thanks for joining us.
You've managed to tune your mind waves to the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast. This is episode 4, The Little Movement. I'm Adam Holbert, here with the ever vivacious
Phil Young.
Phil Young. Good times await us as we go into the world of crazy toy shenanigans. Now, this story was made after The Skull, which puts it in the early 1950s. Very short, it's about 8 to 10 pages long. Let's get into it.
The man was sitting on the sidewalk, holding the box shut with his hands. Impatiently, the lid of the box moved, straining up against his fingers. All right, the man murmured. Sweat rolled down his face, damp, heavy sweat. He opened the box slowly, holding his fingers over the opening. From inside, a metallic drumming came, a low, insistent vibration, rising frantically as the sunlight filtered into the box. A small head appeared, round and shiny, and then another. More heads jerked into view, peering, craning to see.
I'm first,
one head shrilled. There was a momentary squabble, then quick agreement. The man sitting on the sidewalk lifted out the little metal figure with trembling hands. He put it down on the sidewalk and began to wind it awkwardly, thick-fingered. It was a brightly painted soldier with helmet and gun, standing at attention. As the man turned the key, the little soldier's arms went up and down. It struggled eagerly. Along the sidewalk, two women were coming, talking together. They glanced down curiously at the man sitting on the sidewalk, at the box and the shiny figure in the man's hands.
50 cents,
the man muttered.
Get your child something to...
Wait,
a faint metallic voice came.
Not them.
The man broke off abruptly. The two women looked at each other and then at the man and the little metal figure. They went hurriedly on. The little soldier gazed up and down the street, at the cars, the shoppers. Suddenly it trembled, rasping in a low, eager voice. The man swallowed.
Not the kid,
he said thickly. He tried to hold on to the figure, but metal fingers dug quickly into his hand. He gasped.
Tell them to stop,
the figure shrilled.
Make them stop.
The metal figure pulled away and clicked across the sidewalk, its legs still and rigid. The boy and his father slowed to a stop, looking down at it with interest. The sitting man smiled feebly. He watched the figure approach them, turning from side to side, its arms going up and down.
Get something for your boy. An exciting playmate. Keep him company.
The father grinned, watching the figure coming up to his shoe. The little soldier bumped into the shoe. It wheezed and clicked. It stopped moving.
Wind it up,
the boy cried. His father picked up the figure.
How much? 50 cents.
The salesman rose unsteadily, clutching the box against him.
Keep him company. Amuse him.
The father turned the figure over.
You sure you want it, Bobby?
Sure, wind it up.
Bobby reached for the little soldier.
Make it go.
I'll buy it,
the father said. He reached into his pocket and handed the man a dollar bill. Clumsily, staring away, the salesman made change.
Here we discover that the toy in question is a very discerning little chap. He has an agenda, and he's... not afraid to express his opinions to his salesman, who is really just a front.
Yeah, the toy is, in appearance, a small wind-up metal toy soldier of the kind that I guess was around in the 50s.
Yeah, I tend to imagine him with a little red coat, little black hat, gold buttons.
Yeah, now this guy, this soldier's definitely calling the shots. Two women come up, the salesman starts to spruik his wares, and he's like, nope, shut up, these guys aren't right. Then a man, we're assuming a father, and his boy rock up, and the salesman starts to kind of go, oh, not these guys. And the toy soldier just jumps out of the box and starts marching around in a delightfully captivating way, which I know I wouldn't be able to resist. And the child certainly was unable to resist. And reluctantly, the salesman sold said soldier for the princely sum of 50 cents.
It's a bargain.
Got it for 50. Price. Isn't that how much the wub cost?
The wub?
In episode 1?
I'm not entirely sure.
I think so. I remember you saying he got it for Fitty.
A pound of flesh.
This is another example, harking back to the wub, of a disconcertingly cheap sale for something that seems extremely awesome.
Though in the 50s, you have to take into consideration inflation between now and then. I'm sure a packet of Craven A cigarettes would have gone for a few pence. 50 cents would have been a carton.
Maybe. Okay. Well, I guess it depends. We don't know if it's set in the future or parallel universe.
No clues are given, in fact. So we can only assume it's Earth.
Yes, we're assuming it's Earth, which is a different setting to some of our other... I guess last reading was set on Earth. But this is interesting because it's kind of around the time that it was written. There's nothing overtly futuristic. Even the toy itself is wind up, which seems pretty cool. It's sentient. But when it's bought, they don't know that it's sentient. It just looks like a cool wind-up soldier.
Yeah, Philip doesn't really give us any preamble or set the scene. He just jumps straight in, like he does with so many of his other novels, actually. He just jumps straight in and lets us make it up as we go.
Okay. So, yeah, he buys it with a dollar bill. So he has a dollar bill on him, so it's obviously not prohibitively expensive. Fast forward to the bedroom of the boy and from the perspective of the soldier himself.
The situation was excellent. The little figure lay quietly, thinking everything over. All circumstances had conspired to bring about optimum solution. The child might not have wanted to stop, or the adult might not have had any money. Many things might have gone wrong. It was awful even to think about them. But everything had been perfect. The little figure gazed up in pleasure where it lay in the back of the car. It had correctly interpreted certain signs. The adults were in control, and so the adults had money. They had power, but their power made it difficult to get them. Their power and their size. With the children, it was different. They were small, and it was easier to talk to them. They accepted everything they heard, and they did what they were told. Or so it was said at the factory. The little metal figure lay lost in dreamy, delicious thoughts.
It seems there's a plan afoot.
Terribly ominous situation.
Nice.
There's something about the delight that this toy soldier has in his current situation. His plan's coming together. Delicious thoughts, dreamy anticipation. It's all a bit sordid and weird.
It is a bit, yeah. The text is so flowery all of a sudden because it's been quite spare up till now. It really is like a fantasy world. It's not a cold, calculating plan. It's a bit lascivious.
But we're also introduced to the crux of the story, which is power, and that the adults have power, and the toy soldier is after that power.
Yeah, and the children are the way to indirectly confront the power of the adults.
Which is, I guess, in some way, Philip K. Dick's way of analysing adulthood and indoctrination to certain mindsets. He's always interested in movements and religion and power and control. He's making the difference between adults and children as though they are from different worlds. And the toy also does this. He's the mechanism for this, to deconstruct the difference between a child's mind and an adult's mind, which separates them.
Yeah, well, child and adult throughout this story are both treated as proper nouns. They're capitalized, which really... I find it a really interesting device to really separate them almost as two different species based on power rather than physiology. This then takes us to the point where the soldier is first talking with the child. There's a really interesting transition of power because it begins with the boy running upstairs to his room, coming to the soldier and saying, "Hey, what's your name? Welcome." To which the soldier doesn't answer, being a toy. Introducing, saying, "I'll introduce you around. Here's who have we got? Bonzo and Fred and Teddo. They're all a whole heap of stuffed animals that... well, not literal stuffed animals.
Fred's actually a pink rubber pig.
Pink rubber pig? A wubber pig.
You know, I can't stop thinking about the toys that J.F. Sebastian has in Blade Runner that welcome J.F.
home. Yeah, well, they were almost... They had a very wind-up kind of quality to their movement.
Yeah, there was a Napoleonic soldier and then there was a teddy bear.
Oh, you're right.
I don't remember the third.
No, interesting. I don't know if there was a pink rubber pig. Yeah, that's a nice nuance. Yeah, well, what's interesting to me in this section is naming a very powerful device. It's a way of exercising power. Adults will name children. Humans will name animals. Even, I think, biblically, Adam was given the right to name all creation, and that was an act of power, in the way I understand that being communicated. And here there's a real... He's trying to decide on a name for this soldier, and then the soldier turns around and talks to him and says, "I'll give you a name, you'll call me my lord." And at that moment there's a very sudden and swift and decisive shift in the power dynamic. It's no longer a child, a big child playing with a little toy. It's a little toy directing a child.
We knew this all along because Mr. Soldier always had his mind intent on children because they were acquiescent and they were used to being told what to do by the adults. That's his angle. He's getting in there, driving a wedge between the child and the adults.
Right, so when he... I think one of the first things he says is, "Lift me up. Hurry up, don't just sit there." And I guess, yeah, you're right, he's capitalising on the fact that children are used to following orders. So it won't occur to them to exert authority in that situation. And that's pretty much what happens here. The child's fairly scared and reluctant, but does eventually acquiesce and succumbs to an interview, basically, from the soldier.
Which brings us to the Our Little Secret conversation.
"Good. Listen to me. I don't want you to say anything to them about me. I'm your friend, your secret friend. They won't be interested in hearing about me. I'm not going to hurt you, remember? You have nothing to fear. I'm going to live right here with you."
It watched the boy intently, lingering over the last words.
"I'm going to be a sort of private teacher. I'm going to teach you things. Things to do, things to say. Just like a tutor should. Will you like that?"
Silence.
"Of course you'll like it. We could even begin now. Perhaps you want to know the proper way to address me. Do you want to learn that?"
"Address you?"
Bobby stared down.
"You are to call me..."
The figure paused, hesitating. It drew itself together proudly.
"You are to call me my lord."
Bobby leapt up, his hands to his face.
"My lord," the figure said relentlessly. "My lord. You don't really need to start now. I'm tired."
The figure sagged.
"I'm almost run down. Please wind me up again in about an hour."
The figure began to stiffen. It gazed up at the boy.
"In an hour, will you wind me tight? You will, won't you?"
Its voice trailed off into silence. Bobby nodded slowly.
"All right," he murmured. "All right."
It seems to me that this wine, this dependence on being wound, is the hugest chink in the soldier's armor. He needs to be wound.
Yeah, well, later on if I can jump ahead a little bit, the soldier expresses that they actually have, you know, he's working in organization with other wind-up toys, and they have to make sure that a few of them are wound up at all times to keep an eye on the salesman who's the point of distribution, because if they all became unwound at any one time, everything's lost, because he's kind of fears them and doesn't want to necessarily do what they want. Yeah, it's a very interesting interdependence. And it kind of, to me, expresses that idea of power, that it's a mental phenomenon. It's the way that a few people can control a mass of people, despite the fact that if there was an uprising, those few people obviously wouldn't be able to contain that uprising.
Mm. It's the dichotomy of codependence.
And it's about at this time we get to the plan, like the real... A toy aeroplane flies in and they start discussing how everything's going. And this really lays out how their plot to really gain power is progressing.
There came a faint humming sound. Something small flew suddenly into the room. The small object circled a few times and then came slowly to rest on the white cloth of the dresser top beside the metal soldier. It was a tiny toy airplane.
How's it going?
The airplane said.
Is everything all right so far?
Yes, my lord said. And the others?
Not so good. Only a handful of them managed to reach children.
The soldier gasped in pain.
The largest group fell into the hands of adults. As you know, that is not satisfactory. It is very difficult to control adults. They break away, or they wait until the spring is unwound.
I know, my lord nodded glumly.
The news will most certainly continue to be bad. We must be prepared for it.
There's more?
Tell me. Frankly, about half of them have already been destroyed, stepped on by adults. A dog is said to have broken up one. There's no doubt of it. Our only hope is through children. We must succeed there, if at all.
The little soldier nodded. The messenger was right, of course. They had never considered that a direct attack against the ruling race, the adults, would win. Their size, their power, their enormous stride would always protect them. The toy vendor was a good example. He had tried to break away many times, tried to fool them and get loose. Part of the group had to be wound at all times to watch him, and there was that frightening day when he failed to wind them tight, hoping that...
You're giving the child instructions?
The airplane asked.
You're preparing him?
Yes.
He understands that I'm going to be here. Children seem to be like that. As a subject race, they have been taught to accept. It's all they can do. I am another teacher, invading his life, giving him orders. Another voice.
What do we know of their plan? We know it's not going too well.
There have been huge losses. In fact, the little plane divulges that there's only three left. When we were on the sidewalk, there was a number of eager heads in the box. And now we've been reduced down to three, I think. So all is not good.
I think a lot of them fell into the hands of adults who didn't wind them or who allowed them to get crushed.
And are fairly incredulous of a speaking toy soldier.
A dog broke one.
Mm-hmm. Tough world out there.
Yeah, it's very much... the idea of a frontline warfare becomes really apparent. I mean, symbolically, they are military. They're planes and they're soldiers. And
they're made of metal.
They're made of metal. They're talking in terms of casualties and strategies...
And they have ambition as well. They toy with the notion of their own factories and dyes and machines to make themselves bigger. They have the military-industrial complex in mind.
Yes, well, they're now moving to a second phase. I can't remember. Is that second phase to procure another factory?
I believe it's to actually acquire weapons, machine guns and tanks.
Weapons, yep. And because there's not many left of them, that's particularly crucial to have firepower. a lot now hinges on the child that we're following, who I don't think is named at any point, which is why we keep referring to him as the child. But a lot relies on him because he needs to make a delivery. He's actually really the only child that they've effectively got under their control.
And he's also tired, and he's also bound to his school commitments and his homework as well.
Yeah.
So he's fitting all this in.
Yeah, so he's meant to collect something from a toy store, Don's Toyland. I assume that's where the weapons have been delivered. So it's a very... What we have here is a picture of a very fairly intricate plan where a lot can go wrong. I'm kind of imagining it like young turtles being hatched and getting to the ocean. The hope is they're putting a lot of resources with the hope that, you know, one or two will end up surviving. In this case, obviously getting to the ocean is, we assume, overthrowing the human race.
Or undermining the adult's power in some way.
Right, because they still need people to wind them.
I kept on thinking that one toy could wind the other toy.
You've started the second phase? So soon?
My lord was amazed.
Why? Is it necessary so quickly? The factory is becoming anxious. Most of the group has been destroyed, as I said.
I know. My lord nodded absently.
We expected it. We planned with realism, knowing the chances.
It strode back and forth on the dresser top.
Naturally, many would fall into their hands. The adults are everywhere, in all key positions, important stations. It's the psychology of the ruling race to control each phase of social life. But as long as those who reach children survive...
It's called The Movement, their organization.
Capital M. I keep coming back to this use of capitals because they're so small and kind of laughable. The use of capitals makes them seem, maybe it's a little pompous, but also to them it's very serious. You know, I mean, it's called The Little Movement, which is almost, it's a bit deprecating.
It is, and it also is evocative of clockwork and watch movements as well.
Oh, yes.
What I like is the way the child refers to the toy as my lord, and then in the written text, it's referred to as my lord.
Oh, whenever it's thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is pretty great. I think that certainly adds to the pomp as well. Yeah. This here is where the twist occurs. So we've just at the end of that reading, he's actually cut off because Teddo starts to talk to him. Now, up to this moment, we didn't know these animals had any kind of sentience.
Fred leaped, and at the same time, Teddo began to climb swiftly, catching onto the handles of the dresser. Expertly, he gained the top. My lord was edging toward the wall, glancing down at the floor far below.
So this is what happened to the others, it murmured. I understand. An organization waiting for us. Then everything is known.
It leaped.
So what we have here is a coup. They execute a ninja-like operation.
Yeah.
They jump up to the top of the shelf. They work together, jump up to the top of the shelf.
Bonzo covers the exit by the window. He gets bumped off.
They gather up the pieces and get them under the carpet. It's pretty brutal. It's like, all of a sudden, that's it. Just before he dies, my lord realizes, this is what happened to the others. I understand an organization waiting for us. Then everything is known. And they're his last words. Organization, of course, in capitals. So, the movement versus the organization. At the close of the story, Teddo and Fred are talking.
When they had gathered up the pieces and had got them under the carpet, Teddo said,
"That part was easy. Let's hope the rest won't be any harder."
"What do you mean?" Fred said.
"The package of toys, the tanks and guns."
"Oh, we can handle them. Remember how we helped next door when that first little lord, the first one we ever encountered?"
Teddo laughed.
"It did put up quite a fight. It was tougher than this one. But we had the panda bears from across the way."
"We'll do it again," Fred said. "I'm getting so I rather enjoy it."
"Me too," Bonzo said from the window.
So what I'm gathering here is that these animals have, or these toys, they seem to be acting the role of protectors. They don't seem to want to be getting power for themselves.
They're animals. They're pigs and pandas and teddies. They're not metal machines. They're not war toys. They're benign toys. Maybe they're at odds with the kind of toys that kids can play with. Maybe that's in itself a metaphor for the struggle within a child's mind, whether a child becomes seduced by the ideas of war and power or love and friendship and nurturing.
That makes a lot of sense because the other toys hadn't tried to manipulate the child at any point.
And as far as we know, the child is unaware of their sentience.
Those toys have accepted the names they were given. Kind of an unsettling feeling, though, because the pathway from children to adult, it's not really treated very sympathetically. Children do seem to be a little bit oppressed in my reading of it. Like the very fact that the child's wearily going to school, wearily obeying orders, doing what it's told. There does seem to be a feeling that the status quo isn't that great. Something that felt like it should have a pretty strong moral resolution. I actually was left feeling a little bit like, what is to be gained from this?
I felt the same way in that I actually felt this was the first chapter of something a bit bigger. Something that could have gone to somewhere else.
Right.
So very abruptly left high and dry. Maybe he exhausted that concept. Maybe there wasn't anything in there thematically for him to go on with.
It is another take, as you pointed out, on these ideas of wide-scale movements and revolutions and how in the skull there was that idea of a widespread social movement can be traced back to a very small event. And can that event be eradicated or is that inevitable? And here it's kind of the opposite idea, whereas the skull found that the movement was inevitable, the little movement, it kind of never had a chance. I mean, it's interesting because it's long before Toy Story and before the idea that these things that children invest so much emotional energy in have their own complex existence. And I think it's very sympathetic to the world of the child because it's giving credit that all these things have complex political motivations and have discrete identities and operate in the world of imagination, which is as large as the external world. And I think those are themes that recur quite frequently in Philip's work. But yeah, certainly this came as a surprise to me and I haven't read anything like it since.
Maybe. It seems Philip has an underlying preoccupation with the quashing of an idea or the quashing of the beginnings of a movement or a potential new way of organising society or seeing things. He always puts that little kind of inception there and then writes a story around how it's killed.
I mean, I can't help thinking of it in terms of the gun too. If these warlike mechanisms were able to get a few factories going, then it would be inevitable that would become the reality. That's certainly an ongoing theme. But it seems usually that's what happens.
But it was also doomed to fail in my mind, because children always become adults.
Right, yes, and this was the whole separating of them into two species was probably the Achilles heel in terms of strategy. Yeah, the lack of realization that although they seem so different, there is going to be that transition. Yeah, I wonder what the take of the other toys is on that.
Well, I don't know what the take is of the other toys, but I'm just really amazed at their ability to jump the fence and help the neighbor out as well.
So with a squad of pandas.
Yeah, they're not just protecting their own turf in the bedroom. They're a neighborhood watch.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the French Resistance.
Yeah, everything's happening completely underground. And that's kind of why this story could be set at the time that it was written. I mean, it's really, there's nothing to say that any of the technology is anything other than what could have been experienced at the time, except that these soldiers could talk, and who knows how they came to be alive. It could be an alien race. It could be a military weapon. It could be
a highly sophisticated automata that was initially there to entertain, and then it unfortunately maybe turned. Maybe its maker turned them against the adults.
Yeah, it's very... I find it really interesting that there's no reference to how they came about. There's no origin for either the other toys or the soldiers. These toys have become aware of themselves, but they are kind of operating according to a plan that they may not know entirely why or how it fits in.
Because ultimately, the way to change the future is to change the child. Because the child becomes the adult.
So my question to you, Phil, what did you think of this vignette?
Initially, I was a little let down. I felt it was... it wasn't as bold in concept as his other stories, as well fleshed out. And structurally, I found it... It was going somewhere. It felt like it set up a good premise, a bit like Batteries Not Included, and then it just dropped it, as though he got bored, and I felt almost indignant that he would treat me that way. Yeah, I felt it wasn't as rich, texturally as rich as some of his other settings, where he goes into a little bit more detail in describing the climate, the political climate, things around. This is all very much matter of fact. It's very pragmatic. He just laid it out as though this is the toy's agenda, it's dictating it, and then all of a sudden it meets some opposition and it's gone. I found it difficult to reconcile what he was trying to say, what kind of social or political commentary he was trying to get through when he gave me so little. And normally I'd be fine with that. Filling in the gaps yourself is part of what reading's all about, but I just felt he was being lazy.
Yeah, I feel there were some interesting themes in there. Perhaps, as you said, not quite enough material to really grasp onto wider picture. There's definitely a sense that there's more going on in this world than is expressed. But I think also what I found to be a bit of a letdown was just the return of the status quo. It just seemed a bit like nothing was really that much at stake. Nothing. You didn't really want the movement to work. It didn't never seem like it was going to work.
I mean, I'm only clutching at straws here, but maybe... maybe the entire idea behind this is that toys are an extension of a child's imagination. And when a child grows into an adult, they lose their ability to imagine in such a way. So maybe that's where the power struggle lies.
Right. And that's why the status quo is important but not entirely satisfying. So it's kind of like that transition to adult is necessary, but what cost and what is lost and... by how much does the world shrink? Yeah, okay. The battle for the child's mind. And that's certainly something that we encounter in Philip later on, the people who really don't want to close their minds to a point that can operate effectively in existing society, and that being a real problem, as well as something that marks them out as being particularly interesting.
And in some ways, this is mirroring what Philip K. Dick is actually doing by writing science fiction. He's actually trying to play with ideas in other people's minds and free them from seeing things the way they normally see them.
Mm. And I mean, it's quite early in his career as a writer, so I'm sure some of this is him thinking through these issues for himself. Well, the Little Movement, I think we can leave it here for this one. Do you have anything further?
No, not really. I think it does warrant some further investigation into Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, as to the role
yes.
of the toys in that.
Now, listen, we've been trying to record a few of these ahead of time, so unfortunately we don't get to incorporate the feedback from the episode before. We're hoping once we streamline this process a bit, there'll be less lag. But please do get in contact with us via our Facebook group, which is the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast, or email us, pkd@weirdfictionrecords.com. That's an action point. Give us some Blade Runner tie-ins, Blade Runner the movie.
Because all roads end with Blade Runner, really.
This is our working hypothesis, and it's yet to be contradicted.
There were some elements of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep in the Skull as well, talking about the religion or the church, and religion's strongly explored in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep with Mercerism, where Wilbur Mercer is a vehicle for empathy, where the collective, the machine that allows collective consciousness allows people to experience his pain collectively.
See, and this was the other thing with the Little Movement, where there was very little in the way of emotions all around.
Yeah, maybe this is the literary equivalent of an artist's sketch or a doodle. You know, laying out composition without really fleshing in the details.
It's the what if machine.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Maybe it's a good leaping off point. Maybe one of our listeners could explore this world that the Little Movement introduces us to. Maybe tell us a little bit more about the ensuing war.
Yes.
The toy
That would
war.
Be amazing. Alright, well, so next week we have... What have we got coming up next week? Oh, well, not I should say next week. Next podcast. It takes a while, you know, we've got to do some music, we've got to do a bit of editing. We're lazy people at heart. But we will get it to you, and when we do, it will be...
somewhere further on our linear time paradigm.
I thought you knew which one it was.
Oh, I'm talking about when.
Oh, yeah, right. Do you know what? So we can
what?
Read ahead.
Is it The Defenders?
The Defenders! I'm looking forward to The Defenders. That's all I'm saying.
Because the Slem Gun makes a return.
You know that that reason alone. Man, I love it. I love when these details get recycled in stories. Makes it all worthwhile.
There's a lot. He's got a diverse palette, yet he keeps on returning to the same...
It's amazing moments. To me, because it's so soon. You know, this is what story number... we're basing this on his published stories. He may have written more, but this is only his fifth short story. So it's already becoming a world with characteristics and details.
And he's probably only onto his first wife at this time as well.
I don't quite see the parallel with Slam Guns, but...
Oh, I'm just thinking about the timeline of Philip K. Dick's life.
Yeah, well, this is something we can perhaps get into as we go. All right, well, with that in mind, we hope that you will be gathered around the wireless wire pod.
And if you are a highly advanced intelligent being exploring this recording, this primitive recording that you've found from the dust of civilization,
try not to get killed.
Yeah. Could easily happen.
See you soon.